You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, our guest music writer tells us about some of the most influential musicians from Wisconsin.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. This week, the state legislature's nonpartisan budget office released a report showing that it would take about 25 years for taxpayers to recoup the over $2 billion promised to bring a Foxconn plant to Wisconsin.
Robert Menser is a statewide senior editor with USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, good to have you back.
Hi, thanks.
So, Rob, some details in this new report about Foxconn, and long story short, it would take a long time to get the investment money back. What are the details?
Yeah, I mean, right. So the state is investing, proposing to invest $2.85 billion. The project itself is worth something like $10 billion. So from the point of view of a Scott Walker or someone who is favoring this incentive package, you say, well, that's, you know, $10 billion is more. But an awful lot of the proposal is like direct cash payments. By 2021, if the company hires a certain, you know, actually creates a certain number of jobs, they could receive up to $120 million a year for a decade or more, which is, I mean, which is kind of staggering. It's larger in every way than any previous state incentive package for any manufacturer, and so getting the legislative fiscal bureau's look at the data. I think it had a lot of, you know, you could say we're entering a little bit of a backlash stage to the way that the incentive package is structured, and certainly some legislators have spoken about making at least some changes to this.
And proponents have also said that it's not just the jobs that Foxconn itself would generate, it would be the surrounding communities, things like restaurants and additional jobs to support the new influx of workers, right?
Sure, and to some extent, those are accounted for by the Legislative Fiscal Bureau as well. You're also talking about something like 10,000 construction jobs in just the next few years as the proposed campus of buildings would be created, and that's going to affect the whole state. So the numbers are enormous, and I think it's important also to understand Governor Scott Walker's argument all along has been that this project will be transformational. That is, that having this big giant electronics manufacturer in Wisconsin will be the first step toward creating a kind of Midwestern Silicon Valley. Now, if that is true, then it is possible that future generations would look back in 25 years from now when Wisconsin is breaking even on the deal and say that it was a brilliant move because we got Foxconn, and then that caused this other Microsoft manufacturer to come in, and whatever. It changed sort of the nature of the manufacturing economy here. I think that those who had more skepticism about the proposal or are raising more questions about it are just looking at it, in the context of for this manufacturing job, the state would never offer this kind of incentive package for some other manufacturer. So you kind of have to buy into the transformation argument to make this kind of make sense.
And Rob, as I understand it, in terms of recouping the initial investment, part of this is the nature of what Foxconn does, that it would be different if it were, say, a financial services firm that was moving in. What is it about Foxconn?
That's right. Essentially, Wisconsin wants to incentivize manufacturing, period, right? So manufacturing operations pay very low corporate taxes and income taxes, and manufacturing is important to Wisconsin's economy. We have our state's tax code set up in order to incentivize this kind of development. So that's intentional, but it also means that the timeline on something like this, it stretches out. The actual tax revenue over time would be much less.
And you talked about how this has the potential of, if you're looking at this from, say, the governor's perspective, to transform this area of Wisconsin and perhaps, the state in terms of its overall economy. 2.5 decades is a long time, and this is an industry that's known for disruptions. So is there a risk on that side of it?
It's a big risk. It is a big risk. And so it's hard not to look at, you know, this is Governor Scott Walker, also President Donald Trump, were personally involved in these negotiations. And, they have a political incentive. Walker is running for re-election next year, and Trump will be up for re-election a few years after that. So, you know, it might be true. I don't have a position. It might be the case that it's transformational and so on and so forth, but it's not the only incentive here. And then the other thing is Foxconn and all tech industries, all manufacturers have a strong incentive to automate as much as they possibly can in their facilities. So while the upper end of the potential jobs at a Foxconn factory is something like 13,000, a huge number of jobs, the lower end, as mentioned by the Legislative Fiscal Bureau and others, is more like 3,000, depending on the level of automation, when things are phased in, and what types of operations are going, in the facilities. Big development like this, it has effects. It has follow-on effects and ripple effects on the economy. I certainly am not an expert, and it's not my intention to say that that's not the case. But a plant that employs 3,000 people is a lot different in scale than one that employs 13,000.
And Rob, just super briefly before we move on, does this seem to be in favor of the Foxconn deal with lawmakers right now?
So it's just hard to see Republican legislators, blocking this key initiative of the Republican governor. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald and others expressed some reservations. They've already made some changes. Folks who listened to the news at the top of the hour heard some of the ways that that's changing, more worker training investments. They could have a system where there are certain kind of like milestones that Foxconn needs to hit for hiring and so on. It is entirely possible that there will be some changes to the way the incentive package is structured by legislators. But I would bet that it would end up passing.
Talking to Robert Mensah right now, senior statewide editor with USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau. And Rob, this week, the Wisconsin Dairy Business Association announced a lawsuit against the Department of Natural Resources. They want to end Wisconsin's rules on the disposal and storage of manure for CAFOs, these large animal feedlots. What's at issue here?
So the Dairy Business Association, which is a lobbyist and an advocate for dairy farms, they argue that the State Department of Natural Resources does not have the legal authority to regulate a bunch of these, you know, things that historically the DNR has regulated, namely issuing or denying permits for these large farms called CAFOs, or concentrated animal feeding operations. So these are like in these industrial scale farms. This is a growing part of the agricultural sector. There are more CAFOs today by a factor of four, five, I guess, than there were 15 years ago. But they also produce an enormous amount of waste. There are something like 250 large-scale dairy farms. Some have thousands and thousands of cows, and they produce a lot of waste. So when a CAFO tries to move into a new place, there often can be a lot of local resistance to that. And one of the levers by which that can be stopped from happening is if the DNR determines that the environmental impact on the water or so on would be too great. So the Dairy Business Association here argues that that's not the DNR's place. They don't have the legal right to do that, and that permits aren't the business of a state agency.
And what are environmentalists saying about it?
Well, I mean, you can imagine, right? This is this would indeed overturn decades and decades of practice. This is a bit of sort of a legal entrepreneurship, or it's a piece of legal activism on the part of the business group, and it's a novel interpretation. So this would objectively remove a set of environmental checks on these new developments Of course, the argument by the CAFOs is their argument is more like it shouldn't be at the level of permitting. It's on the level of the state agency can regulate and fine and issue penalties if they find that these operations have in fact polluted or are not following rules, but that they shouldn't be the ones to say yes or no, you can have a CAFO here.
And finally, Rob, as we wrap up this week, the National Weather Service confirmed that this has been Wisconsin's wettest year on record, and that's through July. How much rain are we talking about?
Yeah, so sometimes it's nice when the news confirms exactly the thing that you believed was the case. It seems like it's been raining every single day in Wisconsin since about February.
Flooding in various parts of the state.
Yeah. And it is the case, yeah, the National Weather Service says so. So we're talking about 25.25 inches. That is more than 7 inches of rain above average for that January to July period. It is the most since they started tracking this stuff 123 years ago.
Thanks a lot, Rob. We'll see you next week.
All right, thank you.
That was Robert Menser, senior statewide editor with USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau, taking a look with us at the week's biggest news from Wisconsin. Minnesota may have Bob Dylan and Prince, but hey, in Wisconsin we have Bon Iver and the Bodines. And our next guest says Wisconsin artists have had a big impact on the music world.
Evan Retleski is a music editor for the Shepherd Express. Evan, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, when coming up with a list of the most influential Wisconsin musicians, what kind of things did you weigh?
Yeah, you know, I take the word influential really seriously. You know, music critics, we love semantics. So you kind of focus on that word influential. How many people did they influence? How did they inspire future musicians? And, you know, do we still hear the sounds that they created in other people's work?
And we're going to jump around a little bit. I want to start with the number one.
Mm-hmm.
Who is your number one pick for the most influential Wisconsin musician?
It's boring, but it's kind of a no-brainer. It's Les Paul. And a lot of that doesn't have to do with the songs that he wrote or performed themselves, although, you know, in the day they sold millions of records. It's just about the innovations that he brought to rock and roll. He was one of the great pioneers of the electric guitar. He essentially invented one of the most common electric guitars, the most popular electric guitars ever. And he really also created all these techniques for guitar playing that musicians have been borrowing and building on for just decades and decades. In addition to that, he was also a pioneer in the studio. He was one of the first big artists to use multi-tracking as sort of a studio effect on his album. So he just did all sorts of things that were way ahead of his time. And I don't know how music would be different without him. I think he was really one of the building blocks of rock as we know it.
Hard to sum up in just one clip, but here is Les Paul, the Wizard of Waukesha, with Mary Ford. Get a taste of his guitar work there. I want to move on your list to another one near the top here. James Brown's longtime drummer, Madison native, recently passed away. Clyde Stubblefield, big connection, of course, to us here at Wisconsin Public Radio. And before we talk about Clyde, I want to play a couple of things. He's known as the most sampled drummer in music history. Here's a bit from Funky Drummer by James Brown. Here's Clyde's beat.
I walk the floor.
All right, now as we fade out, I'll set up this next one. Our producer, Carl Christensen, did a supercut with that beat in a number of different songs over the years. Here's a listen.
1989, the number, another summer. Sound of the funky drummer. Music hitting your heart because I know you got soul.
Boogie, jive, and rap is life where I'm from. Where I'm from, Ahmad play with Izzy where I'm from. Where I'm from, it be like run your coat black. Jupiter keeps a fat beat.
Yeah, yeah.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Oh. All right, when you've got a beat that unites Public Enemy, LL Cool J, Diggable Planets, George Michael, Ed Sheeran, and the Powerpuff Girls, that is an influential musician. Talk about Clyde Stubblefield a little bit, Evan.
Yeah, that's his legacy. He's another musician where he's influential not just for the songs themselves, although, you know, those were incredible performances on the James Brown records. It's the way that those songs sort of worked themselves into the DNA of modern music as we know it. It didn't just inspire funk. It inspired all forms of pop music, and especially rap, where sort of the backbone that he provided that gave rap producers so much to work with and so much to build on, and we still hear it. I mean, we'll be hearing his samples for decades and decades to come. He really just laid the groundwork for black music as we know it right now.
We're talking right now with Evan Ratlesky, music editor of the Shepherd Express, and talking about his list of the most influential Wisconsin musicians. And Evan, we gotta head to Eau Claire now because you included, justifiably, Justin Vernon from Bon Iver, who's been a breakout and has also seemed like created a music hub in that part of the state.
Yeah, you know, he's got obviously some great records and some songs that'll live on for a long time. But I think his real legacy is likely to be the community he's built in Wisconsin. Before he came around and really was a cheerleader for Eau Claire, nobody really thought of Eau Claire as a big music hub. But here he is showcasing all the music that they've got there. He built a big studio there where bands from around the country travel to record now. And then, of course, he built the Eau Claire's Music Festival, which is really just an incredible, unique music festival that looks like it's going to be around for a long time. So he put the city on the map sort of the way Kurt Cobain did with Seattle back in the 90s. He just really championed his hometown. It was inspiring to see.
And here's a little bit of his song, Flume.
I am my mother on the wall with a song.
So Bon Iver there with Flume. Now, a big name there. Here's one I wasn't as familiar with on your list, and I'll admit I'm not even sure how to pronounce it. John Mueller or Muller?
Oh, yeah. He's one of the more obscure ones. I put him, you know, down a little bit lower on my list of top 10 musicians, but he has been a big figure in two music scenes. He was a big figure in a subgenre known as post-rock, which is a really complex, smart form of kind of indie rock that draws from jazz patterns and whatnot. He's played in a few big post-rock bands, but he's also really big on sort of the experimental side of things. He's run a record label, and he's put out dozens of releases for all kinds of record labels. He's really been one of these guys sort of below the radar who's connected Milwaukee's music scene and Wisconsin's experimental music scenes to sort of the rest of the world. He's really internationally known for the music that he makes, at least in small circles.
Now, we've got a Facebook comment here, Evan. Brian from Facebook votes for the Violent Femmes, and you agree.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And this is a band, you know, with a lot of the other picks, I've sort of focused on their importance for what they contributed to music and how, you know, sort of their innovations were influential. But with the Violent Femmes, it's not really about that. It's just about the songs themselves. They created really one of the great debut rock albums ever. I mean, that first album is just filled with classic songs that we all know, even if some of us don't think they're the Violent Femmes. We all know the rhythms. We hear them at baseball stadiums. And it's just a band that just sort of, I think, inspired a lot of people with their individuality. You know, they were just three guys making music that kind of captured the angst of adolescence. And there was just so much unique about it. They were sort of folky, they were sort of punky, they were sort of jazzy. The singer had one of those voices that made you feel like anybody could be a singer. I think a lot of people started a band because of them.
Let's give a listen, Violent Femmes, and Please Do Not Go.
Tell your mind I'm stuck on this lovely girl. Cross to me, she mean all the world. But then she like another guy.
Violent Femmes, and they're still making music. We talked to one of them not that long ago. They recorded some stuff in Australia and dropped an album last year, I think.
Yeah, it's pretty good, too.
And Evan, tell us who else is on your list.
Yeah, I've got a couple other ones there. Number five on my list would be Garbage, and I sort of weighed where to put them, because this is a band where I think the producer and one of their members is maybe more important than the band themselves. Butch Vig, who used to produce in Madison, he, of course, produced all sorts of huge bands during the 90s alternative boom, including Nirvana, most famously. But, you know, even when you take Butch Vig out of the equation, this band themselves, I think, has held up a lot better than a lot of the 90s rock bands that they came up with. They were sort of stylish at the time in the 90s, but their music hasn't dated that bad. And I think in the 90s, a lot of people heard them, and especially singer Shirley Manson. I think they were inspired. She was sort of an icon back in the day, and they've aged really gracefully.
And we heard Rob on Facebook said, Steve Miller. Can't talk about Wisconsin music without the Steve Miller Band.
Yeah, you know, Steve Miller, certainly in terms of albums sold, he's right near the top. And for me, you know, I just, to me, he just embodies that era of rock and roll, that sort of super studio-centric, kind of electric, proggy, bluesy, all over the place rock. It's kind of inspiring. You listen to those records, and they're really wild. They're all over the place. And the songs, of course, hold up, too.
And Evan, I want to ask you, this is a question, I think, directly from our producer, Carl, who says, this has got to be a little bit controversial. He wants to know, where is the love for Liberace? Should Liberace be on this list?
You know, the honest answer to that is, I don't really know. Liberace, was he influential? I mean, there was only one Liberace, so he's this sort of larger-than-life figure. But unlike some of the other artists on this list, I don't think people heard Liberace and was like, I want to be the next Liberace. Not really possible.
You never know.
So DeKreutz and the Promise Ring and the Bodines round out your list, and you're watching Evan very briefly for new musicians for the future.
Oh yeah, there's quite a few. You know, I'm based in Milwaukee right now, and the Milwaukee music scene is just flush with talent right now.
And we'll go out with one of those talents, Milo. This is a song, Zen Scientist Milo from Milwaukee. Evan, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Now, are women biologically ill-suited to work in high-pressure, high-stress technology fields like computer programming? In a 10-page memo that went viral this week, former Google engineer James Damore said women were inherently different compared to their male colleagues, that women were more prone to stress and anxiety and don't seek out more prominent roles in the field.
The memo was, in short, controversial. It also ultimately led to the firing of Damore. Story broke in the midst of ongoing concerns about the lack of women in programming and leadership positions in Silicon Valley. Our next guest says that historically this wasn't the case and that women were programmers long before men entered the field.
Marie Hicks is a writer and technology historian. She's the author of Programmed Inequality, How Britain Discarded Women Technologists and Lost Its Edge in Computing. She'll join the UW-Madison faculty in the fall. Marie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what was your reaction when this memo first got out there in the public?
I had very little reaction because, honestly, it's just the same old story. This sort of thing comes around every few years or so, and it's just totally untrue, and so it sort of goes away pretty quickly. I think the reason it really blew up this time is because we are realizing more and more that we have a big problem with sexism in the tech industry.
Right. The argument in this memo was the lack of women in these fields isn't sexism. He said it's on average, he was making the case, women have, I guess, temperament, skills, abilities that aren't suited to technology. In your studies, you found that women were the technologists at many points in computer history.
Exactly. Basically, the entire history of computing completely disproves the arguments he's making. And he's making these arguments with the support of junk science that's been debunked for about 20 years anyway. But yes, history of computing shows that women were in very highly technical roles long before men were, because those technical roles used to be devalued. So in fact, women were the first computer programmers, and they did everything from hardware assembly and troubleshooting to systems analysis to computer operation and programming.
We'll spend a lot of our time in the present day, but I want to go back to some of your research and a time just after World War II when there was an emerging power really seemed to control the future of computer technology, Britain. What happened there? What was going on after World War II? And then how did that competitive advantage evaporate?
Yes, it's a very interesting story because the British had the first digital electronic programmable computers. And not only were they first, but they used them during World War II to actually change geopolitical events in a big way. The reason that the Allies knew where and when to land on D-Day was because of the code breaking that these early electronic computers did. And all of these computers were, of course, operated by women. After the war, those machines are kept secret and most of them are broken down, but women continue on in the field through the 50s, the 60s, and into the 70s. However, about the 1960s, there's this push to get more men into the field as managers in government and industry start to understand that computer work is actually more important than they initially thought. And what this does is it causes huge labor shortages because they're pushing out the technologists who actually have the training already, the women, and they're trying to get men into the field who not only don't have the skills or the training, but also aren't too interested in going into the field at this point because the field is seen as kind of low in value because women have been doing it. And this creates this butterfly effect that essentially makes the government consolidate the British computing industry, which had been doing very well, into one large company so that it can provide huge machines to accommodate the government's needs, since now they have this very small labor force of male technocrats to run their computers. And when they do this, the company, ICL, that they've merged and created, it does provide them with the huge mainframe solutions that they want, but it does so in an era when the mainframe, these big mainframes, are on their way out. And so essentially, the British computing industry implodes as a result of the government's self-made labor shortages due to gendered labor discrimination.
Talking to Marie Hicks, technology historian, soon to be a professor at UW-Madison, talking about gender and the high technology world. Marie, let's take that lesson there and maybe apply it to the modern day. We have this is sort of lowly, menial work. We'll let women do it in Britain. Oh, this is really important. We can't leave this to the women to do. It's important stuff, so men do it. So are we seeing similar attitudes at play here today?
Well, we definitely still see bifurcation in the high-tech sector between jobs of very similar skill level and value. We see women kind of getting shoved into certain jobs and men into other jobs. And the ones that are seen as higher prestige and more likely to lead to the C-suite are always the fields that are predominantly men. So we do see the same kinds of things going on. I think now it's a bit less obvious, but it's still very much baked into the structures of many of our institutions.
So what happens girls first and then women maybe consider going into the technology world? What happens between those early efforts to get them interested in the STEM fields and at a point where there may be, 10 or 20% of the workforce in a lot of these fields?
Well, I think what happens is that women start out very interested in STEM. You know, there are lots of women who are interested in these fields in elementary and high school, and even through college. But when they get into the workforce, it's kind of a rude awakening. Take the example of Google itself. This past summer, they refused to comply with a Department of Labor order to actually give information about how they were paying women versus men. They were allegedly paying them, you know, egregiously less than their male coworkers. And Google said, we're not going to give you that information. They said, oh, it's going to cost us $100,000 to give you that information, so that's too much. They wouldn't expend a tiny, tiny amount as a multi-billion dollar corporation to try to correct this problem of pay inequality. Now, when women see that they're undervalued, both in a very material sense, they are being paid less, and also they hear from companies that won't do anything to fix that, that they're not worth essentially helping, well, you know, they make decisions in line with their own best interests. And maybe that means going into another field.
The writer of this memo says, well, but look, Google's doing too much to promote diversity, maybe at the expense of outcomes. They're having programs that try to help young women get into technology. Is there real effort being made by a company like Google, whether the memo writer is right or not, that it's too much?
I think there is real effort being made, but I think that those efforts are a bit confused. They're based on this idea of a STEM pipeline, where if you get women in at an entry level, then eventually they'll work their way up, right? Because it's a meritocracy. Well, what we've seen is that, in fact, Silicon Valley and most places, it's not a meritocracy at all. So these women come in at lower levels and they don't go anywhere. They never get to work their way up. In fact, many of them, instead of, you know, staying at those low levels, they leave and they do something else. So even though technology companies have been trying to correct this problem, they're not really doing it in the way that, you know, social science researchers and historians and other folks who are experts in the field have said, look, this is really the way you need to try to fix these problems. And so their efforts have kind of come to nothing.
We'll get into those efforts in just a bit. Marie Hicks is with us right now, author, technology historian, soon to be at UW-Madison, talking about the controversial Google memo that made the rounds this week, authored by a Google engineer now fired who said women were a bad fit for jobs in the technology field, ultimately because of biology.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. If you work in the tech field, did you see this attitude in your workplace? Did you experience this maybe firsthand? And what did you think of that Google memo? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation now about the Google memo that made the rounds this week that outlined one engineer's, now fired engineer's, opinion that women aren't biologically suited on average to work in the technology field. Marie Hicks is our guest, author and technology historian.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What did you think of the memo? If you're a woman who works in a tech field, what's your experience been like? What would you like to see change? Call us at 800-642-1234, or you can leave a comment over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Before we go to a caller, Marie, wanted to ask you were talking about, well, a lot of the efforts that companies are trying now aren't working. They're not great ideas. What would work to try to give women an equal footing, overcome some of the obstacles in the technology world?
I think the thing that we have to keep in mind when we talk about technology is that it's not unique. Technology is about concentrating and wielding power. And so it's not just about getting women into technology. It's about giving them power within the field and actually allowing them the power to change things in the field. So what needs to happen, and this has been happening a little bit more to some extent more recently, is that women have to be brought in at high levels. They can't just be brought in as entry-level workers and expected to work up. Women from other industries or other parts of the tech industry have to make lateral moves into companies that realize, hey, we have a big problem with this and we are really seriously trying to fix it.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Tammy is on the line in Blue River. Tammy, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say I did get a late start in the tech field. I graduated 2 years ago and was hired on right away at a corporation. And I'm the first female in my position in this company, and I've done phenomenally well. I'm well-liked, well-respected, and I'm doing very well with what I'm doing. So I kind of think what that whole memo was about really doesn't apply.
And Tammy, I want to ask, this is your first job in the field, it sounds like. Do you think you just lucked into something, or do you think that the company you work for did something right?
I think they did something right. They have me working with a wonderful team. I get along great with the people I work with. They're a younger generation, and I haven't had any problems or any reasons why I feel that I would be held back. I feel like they're doing their best for me to help me succeed in what I'm doing.
Tammy, thanks for the call. Congratulations. Is there something about setting up a workplace culture, Marie, that can have more people have experiences like Tammy's?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I would assume a lot of the things that Tammy's employer are doing are, you know, geared to actually make sure that their women who are in the minority don't feel like they're in the minority, don't feel like they're marginalized. I bet none of her coworkers have said things similar to what was said in the Google memo. That's, you know, one big part of it.
Thanks a lot for the call, Tammy. We'll go next to Don on the line in Madison. Don, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? So I had a couple of comments. First, obviously I don't condone that person's memo, and I don't feel that same way. But on the alternative side, I come from a science background, and I've noticed that there's less males coming out of high school going into STEM as well, and there seems to be more of a push for these organizations to reach females, to get more females into the sciences, whereas it seems like males in the science category are being left behind. And in the case of getting hired for certain jobs, it seems like there's a preference to get females into the sciences, where somebody who might be more qualified, a good example of this is a male who may be more qualified, have more education, have been in sciences, actually pushed aside to fill a certain quota. And I don't think that by discriminating against one group, that's necessarily a way to solve the problem that for a group that's been discriminated against for
Don,
the last 30
Don, thanks
years.
For the call. So in effect, Marie, affirmative action, Don is worried about favoring women at the expense of men.
Yes, and that's a worry, that's a perception of what's going on that really doesn't hold water when you actually look at the facts of the situation. I do agree with Don that it would be a shame if young men who are interested in, say, computer science don't have the opportunities to go on in the field, but that's really not what we're seeing in terms of hiring. We're seeing that women are consistently paid less and hired when they have the same qualifications, they are not as likely to be hired. There have been a number of studies done where similar or, in fact, identical resumes will be sent out, one with a man's name and one with a woman's name. And again, the male's resume will get a higher proportion of job offers and much stronger interest than the woman's resume with exactly the same qualifications. So, in fact, women are actually held to a higher standard in these fields and many others.
Don, thanks for the call. As we start to wrap up, Marie, I mean, as you said at the outset, these kind of things, it's the memo this week. There have been other flare-ups, generate a lot of heated conversation. But do you see maybe slowly some kind of positive progress being made when it comes to gender and technology?
I hope so. I think that these flare-ups, as disturbing as they are, these flare-ups, you know, in the media are productive in some way if they get us actually thinking about the problem and thinking about solutions to the problem. So I'm going to be optimistic, hold out hope for what happens next, and hope that this is a conversation that actually leads to some positive change.
Marie, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Marie Hicks, writer and technology historian. She's the author of Programmed Inequality, How Britain Discarded Women Technologists and Lost Its Edge in Computing. She'll begin teaching at UW-Madison this fall.
She joined us to talk about that controversial Google memo that made the rounds this week that detailed one engineer's opinion that women aren't biologically suited to work in the tech field and why she says that line of thinking might slow down technological progress.
And you can find more information and share your thoughts, maybe your experiences if you've worked in this field, just head over to the Central Time Facebook page. Local food is hot stuff right now, and Wisconsin is a leader when it comes to the amount of food being sold directly from the farm. That's according to the first ever local food survey from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. As part of WPR's State of Change series, Danielle Kading takes us to northern Wisconsin, where farmers are working together to get local food to markets.
BLT season is on. Finally. Chris Duke adds a tomato the size of a grapefruit to a box full of vegetables at a packing site in Ashland. The owner of Great Oak Farm in Mason forms an assembly line with three area farmers, packing boxes with lettuce, cucumbers, and greens.
That's like as fresh as you can get, really, unless you came to the farm and picked it yourself.
They're all part of the Bayfield Foods Cooperative. Duke says more than 20 farms in Ashland and Bayfield counties are members.
So our Bayfield Foods Cooperative, it runs this Lake Superior CSA, which is direct to vegetables and produce, fruits, meats, even some value-added stuff in boxes going directly to people.
The cooperative also has a wholesale program where they deliver food to restaurants and stores across the Twin Ports and north central Wisconsin. Duke says when they sell as a co-op, the farms feel less pressure to meet every demand from consumers, retailers, and institutions.
If you have a wholesale buyer and they're like, okay, we want, you know, a pallet of tomatoes every week, and your tomatoes are 3 weeks late because it's cold out, that means you just lost 3 weeks of income, and that's really tough to climb out of, you know, early in the season.
Plus, they've been able to pool resources to build the infrastructure necessary to store and deliver food across the region.
That's the last box on the line.
River Road farm owner Todd Rothy says the cooperative CSA has allowed him to expand production.
Incredibly so. Yeah, we couldn't have realized the growth that we have in the last 6 years without doing the CSA, honestly. I mean, having the support of households, you know, families that buy our products directly from us and give us a really good price for it.
About 70% of their food goes out to people who have bought boxes ahead of time through the CSA. The remaining 30% is sold to stores and restaurants. Over the last 5 years, they've nearly tripled the amount of vegetable boxes sold directly to members. But Rothy and other farmers still rely on other income to make ends meet. Someday he'd like to work solely on the farm.
That's the goal, yep. But I'm just still in the process of growing my farm operation to get to that point.
UW Extension Ag agent Jason Fishbach says it's hard for farmers to make the math work. There aren't that many people in northern Wisconsin to support local growers, so farmers have to sell to larger markets. They may also lack the scale to provide a consistent supply. Plus, he says local farms can't produce food cheap enough.
They have to do a really good job of convincing the buyers that the higher price is worth it, that they get better quality. A number of producers have gotten bigger in order to get their cost of production lower, and they've also been able to sell their product as a higher quality, higher value product.
Farmers are also challenged with meeting consumers' desire for convenience as meal delivery services like Blue Apron have grown more popular, according to Keitra Olson with the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture.
The public sees it as sort of another Blue Apron. You know, they send you, all of the ingredients that you need and instructions on how to make something. A lot of people who signed up for CSAs, I think, were expecting more flexibility.
Great Oak Farms Duke says they've worked hard to listen to what people want. By working together, he says they're able to spend less time worrying and more time in the field.
That way, we can do what we do best, which is grow food.
And they're exploring ways to get more local food out there. The co-op recently received a state grant that will allow them to eventually ship local meal kits to customers in Minnesota and Wisconsin. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can listen to other stories in the State of Change series by visiting WPR.org/change.